Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Pixels, a podcast for the discerning gamer. Hello everyone, and welcome back to Pixels. This is a show where we cover the news from the gaming world from the past couple of weeks or so. We cover news for PC, consoles, mobile even, news from the industry. We try to have an analytical angle to all of this to understand and explain what's happening on top of course, our impressions on games. But today is a little bit different because we're going to be talking with developers from the acclaimed Dead Cells game that came out a few weeks ago. My name is Patrick Beja, and I have to say, I have fallen in love with Dead Cells. I've played it way more than I should, given the fact that I have a small baby at home, and I didn't think I was going to love it so much, but I definitely did. And I don't usually do interviews. I don't love the format, but for Dead Cells, I figured I have to try and talk to some of the devs because it is such a phenomenon and such an interesting game and development and company. So I figured it would be a really interesting conversation. I hope it will be. I know that the two people that we have here today are definitely going to be telling us fascinating stuff about the game. So without further ado, let me introduce them. First, Sébastien Bénard, who is lead developer and designer on the game. How's it going, Sébastien?
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us at the show.
I'm really happy to have you because you're the lead developer and designer. Of course, you told me before we started that everyone at the company was a lead something, but still, it's still, you know, it's a lot. Lead developer and designer. It sounds really impressive.
We have a very flat system. So yes, everyone is a lead or not a lead.
Yeah. So actually, that is one of the characteristics of the company. You're a relatively small company. I mean, I think everyone knows Dead Cells and the fact that you're an indie dev, I think, an indie company. And the second person we have on the show today is Thomas Vasseur, who is also lead artist and co-CEO of the company. Amazing. Thank you for being on, Thomas.
Nice to meet you. Everybody is co-CEO in this company.
Shh, actually, don't say that. Don't keep the...
It's very classy to say.
Yeah,
to
it looks nice on business cards, so that's why.
That's something we might dive into later in the show. The structure of the company is really interesting because it's a super flat structure, and it's even a special type of legal entity where every employee has equal parts and salary and everything in the company, which is surprising. So maybe we'll talk about how that works towards the end of the show. But first, let's talk about the game itself. For people, I mean, I'm sure everyone who has ever listened to this show knows what Dead Cells is because it's been making a lot of noise in the media for the past few weeks and months. But maybe could you explain to us what you, how you would define that game? What is Dead Cells?
Actually, we have two definitions for it. We have the bullshit marketing thing, which is we call this a Rogvania, which is like a mix between a roguelite and a Castlevania. And for us, it's more like we made this game to make actually a Castlevania that you just can replay as much as you want, which is different every time you play. So it's more like this is really designed as a Castlevania that you can play again and again.
That's what I understood in... I unlike people might think, I do prepare my shows. And one of the things you said was really interesting, basically what you're saying now, the intent wasn't to make a roguelike. It was to make a Castlevania, but because of the budget constraints of an indie developer, you had to make sure it was really replayable. And that's when the random nature of the levels and the replayability, acquiring gear and everything when you accumulate cells and when you replay it, came into play. It was budget constraints, right?
Yeah, but it was also the most stupid idea that we ever had, because making things random like this and procedural and everything, it actually required much more work to actually fine-tune everything so it worked in real life.
And at the end, we had to level design every level in the game. So we had the worst parts on the two sides, generation and design. Together.
So you think it took actually maybe as much time or almost as much time or maybe more time to go that route with the randomness?
Yeah, definitely. You know, when you, as a developer, when you actually decide to make something random, it actually takes like maybe one day to make something that works, that produce a result in any kind of quality. But if you want to have a quality result every time you generate something, it takes more like few months to actually get your generator right. So you have really, really quick results, and this is a trap, actually, because you just take a few weeks or months to actually have something good every time you generate something.
Yes. Mm. The nice part of the generation was for the graphics and the background design, because I think it took me a lot of time to put all the details in the background by myself. And our generator did that for me. And it was wonderful.
Yes, but we probably spent, I'm not sure, maybe three to six months just making this specific generator.
Yes.
It was background generator.
So even the generator that made this quicker process was like a really long time in development.
Yeah, definitely.
How long was development? Because I know you've been in you were in early access for about a year and a half, I think. How long was development overall?
It depends if you consider just Dead Cells as a Rogvania thing, or if you consider the whole project, which is actually a little bit longer. It's more like 4 years, something.
Yes, yes.
Because it used to be something really different before. It used to be
the tower defense. The tower defense follow-up to Horde?
Yeah, that was a previous stupid idea that we had. and actually, when we decided to switch to Rogvania, it took maybe 2 years and a half.
Two years and a half, and maybe 1 year and a half to make it on the early access.
Yeah.
That's really interesting as well, because I think... part of good development is to try ideas and to know when they're not working and to be able to pivot or to abandon an idea that is really dear to you. Maybe sometimes it's, you know, even in writing, I think a common teaching of writers in cinema, among other things, is to be able to kill your babies, meaning that idea that you really love, that you thought was great, to be able to realize that it doesn't work and maybe abandon it or switch to something else. And it feels like what you did with the development of that, what was initially a 2D tower defense with a preparation phase and then an action phase, was something you really wanted to do. What made you decide that it just didn't work and you had to switch to something else and abandon, according to what you're saying, I'm guessing, maybe a year of ideation and development?
Actually, I do like to kill babies, so that's not a crime for me.
maybe that's the next game.
Yeah.
You have to know he's dead now.
Oh, I'm not sure. I knew that. And I don't have any kind of problem when I cancel something, because for me, it's really part of the job, especially when you do game design. Sometimes you have the best idea on paper, which looks like the next great thing. And when you make it, it's really just dumb and not funny at all. Mm. And that's what happened with the previous version of Dead Cells. You know, when we make a game, there is this moment when you actually, for example, you are testing something in your game as a developer, you're implementing something, you build your game and you just run it just to check if your idea works or small thing that you did work. And actually you lose like 30 minutes because you get into the game and you just play and you forget about testing your feature. Mm. And when this kind of thing happens, it's actually a good thing. But on the previous version of the game, that never happened. So at one point we thought, okay, maybe there is something really wrong with the game. So that's why.
Mm. And just to give a little bit of context, Motion Twin used to create Flash games, free-to-play Flash games on the web. And you were doing that for many years. And when the industry evolved with smartphones and everything, you pivoted. I mean, free-to-play and web games meant a very different thing back then when you were doing it. But that's where you were coming from. And you shifted to PC games or traditional games for this. This is your first project as a full, I want to say, full PC and console game. So, so let's get back before we dive too deep into game design, which we will. But as I was saying, I think a lot of people have really fallen in love with the game, and I would say I didn't expect. When I first played the game in early access many months ago, when it first released, I thought it was going to be good, but I didn't think it was going to be that beloved. And I want to ask you guys, what did you expect for the game, maybe before it came to early access and once it was released, you know, those two stages? Was the reaction of the community and the public what you expected? Was it more or less? How did you react for those two steps, maybe starting with early access?
It was not something that we expected, like, at all, because you know, when we went to early access, it was the company was not in a great shape, so it was really necessary for us to go live and to actually start selling the game. So we were not very comfortable with this idea at this point, and especially because everyone was talking about this indie apocalypse and everything. And so right before the early access, we actually drawn on a whiteboard our estimation on sales and ops and everything. So it was really more like the smallest one, it was 10,000 units, because it was really the minimum that we would require to just survive.
It was the marketer estimation.
And for most, it was maybe around 30,000 to 60,000 units, no more than
and
this.
And me, I bet on 100,000. It may be very presumptuous, but I always believe in this project because I've played a lot with Castlevania Symphony of the Night, and Sebastian make a game with me, and when I played it, I never played a game like this before. Mm. And I was pretty sure it would be a success. I did not know how many people could play it, but I was pretty sure it could work for us.
But even with the highest estimation, actually, it was really much, much bigger than we expected. And it took us by surprise, because we really, even if we really opted to be quite a success, we didn't thought it would be this much of success.
I was very surprised now how many people play Dead Cells right now, 1 year after the early access. That is the very impressive part.
Well, I guess the actual release of the game was the moment when everyone jumped in. I mean, you sold a lot of them. I'm guessing you don't talk about numbers. We've seen estimations on Steam Spy and stuff like that. But yeah,
we could talk about it. There is no problem about it.
Oh, sure.
Maybe
so,
yeah. The exception is maybe the console market because we...
That's what's interesting. I mean, everyone has Steam Spy numbers. But
actually, we can talk about it because I can't remember the number right now, but we can say how they compare, especially. Everyone knows it like a small secret, but everyone knows that the Switch does perform much, much better than anyone else.
Right, and that's the case for you as well. I guess for these kinds of games, when people have a choice between PS4 or Switch, they usually get it on Switch, which is what I did to have the advantage of being able to play it wherever. But it reflects for your sale numbers as well.
Yeah, definitely. I'm not sure. I think it's maybe like 5 times more on Switch or something like this.
Yes, it is.
Wow.
So it's really different. You're right, because we designed this game as a run-based game, so you can play it for like 1 hour or less. So it's really made for takeaway. So if you want to have it in your pocket, it's always better. Mm.
So numbers-wise, I think the Steam Spy numbers were 250,000 after 1 year or the access. Maybe I'm mistaken.
After 1 year, no, it was more like après l'année de.
Je crois qu'on est.
Maybe it was 700 or 1,000.
Oh wow! Okay, so basically you're all swimming in money, which is great. I think you deserve it. but I guess that we can talk about that as well at some point. But that changes, especially for a company like yours, where it's just. There is no discussion of who gets bonuses and who contributed the most. It's just everyone gets their share. If there's, 12 employees, you split the thing in 12 and everyone gets their share. It makes things, I guess, if some people think they contributed more, they might be a bit salty. But when you get into it, you know that this is what you're going to get. And it makes things easier, I suppose. But...
Yeah, definitely. When you don't have to talk about how you contributed to the project, maybe if you have a small contribution to the project, it doesn't mean that if you remove this contribution, the project will probably collapse. Because even if for example, the sound, it's not something which takes as long as the development. But if you remove the sound, the game just doesn't work. So it's really not a matter about how much time you did put in the project, but more like what makes the project actually work. So it can even small things are important. We all know that.
Mm. And this is a very complicated process for us to hire someone. You have to know, when we hire someone, we are always looking for someone better than us. So because it assures us that he will deserve his share because he's better than us.
That's an interesting way of looking at it.
It's very hard for us to hire someone.
So I think when you started talking about the structure of the company, you also acknowledged that this probably only works with a relatively small structure. So I'm guessing the small structure is something you're attached to. You again, I'm guessing, but you wouldn't want to grow to a much bigger company, or you would have to change something, I guess.
Yeah, we did try to grow years ago. We went until maybe 20 people, but that was not the greatest experience that we have at Motion Twin. And if we really want to keep exactly the same system and same gameplay, company gameplay, we actually have to stick to small numbers. But for us, it's fine, because we think if you optimize stuff, you can actually make big things, even if there is very few people. And for example, the art of Dead Cells and all the animation, it was really, everything was done by just two people. And but that's because we really optimized the process and we had to figure new ways to do things. But that's also part of the fun, so that's fine for us.
Mm. I guess that's Dead Cells feels like a game that could not have been made by a less experienced company. It feels like there's enough familiarity in the production pipeline and process to tackle the challenges of the new parts of the development, things that you had to create. And you mentioned, I do want to ask more about the game in general, but since you mentioned the graphical aspects and, you know, we have the lead artist, not just an artist, let's talk about the graphics for a second, because it is retro pixelated. But my understanding is that this is actually a 3D engine, which is underlying the graphics process. And this is why we get such the iconic pixel graphics, but with smooth animation, right?
Yes, you have to know that our process on Dead Cells is not different than the Donkey Kong Country process, which is a very old game. We just used old process to do this. But
you mean the 3D, yes. 3D rendering, and then you create the sprites out of the...
Yes, in order to animate characters, because I tried maybe... we did a few games with Sébastien before Dead Cells, and I tried animation by hand, and it was very long. And we really wish to make a game bigger than Castlevania Symphony of the Night. And this game has 100 monsters and characters, and we really needed to figure out how to do this right.
So what made you think, so again, if I understand right, to explain to people who might not know the old Donkey Kong, you create the models in 3D, you apply the shaders and whatever, and then you actually kind of print the sprites, each individual step of animation, but you use the 2D models, the 2D printed, quote-unquote, well, I'm saying printed, that's not correct, but you create images for each step of animation, and the actual game, the executable that you play on your console, doesn't have a 3D engine. It just uses those 2D bitmaps for the game, right? Like a traditional 2D game.
Exactly. The game is actually in 3D, technically speaking, but yes, it's exactly the process that you explained. Mm.
At the beginning, I was very afraid that our gamers will see the process behind the render.
Yeah.
And I planned initially, I planned to delete some frames to make it look more 2D. And we did not. I did not have time to do that, so we put a demo very early, and the player said, "Oh, it's very smooth. It's very fluid."
Yeah.
And I never cropped the animation.
We do use a small trick. Actually, that made everything possible. It was Thomas' idea at the beginning. But you know, when you make a new character in a game, usually you just make a concept art and then you make the 3D model out of it. And in this case, in Dead Cells, Thomas actually produced the concept art of the character in pixel art. So it's really the right size that will appear in the game. So when he makes a 3D model out of this concept art, he can make sure that if there is a one pixel detail, like a belt or the eyes or anything like this, which is really small, he can actually make the polygons the right size. So when they will turn back into 2D after, they will actually appear properly in-game as one pixel things.
Mm. Yeah. And the truth is, I'm not very happy with the render of characters, but I am... Because you can see games like Old Boy or other game like this with very detailed characters, but for Dead Cells we really need to have a very snappy animation, and the better tool for me to do a good animation was 3D, and you can see this in the latest Dragon Ball Fighters.
Right.
Or Guilty Gear X3rd, I think. Yeah. Those two games really impresses me. So I really wish to do the same.
But those have like anime type graphics. Obviously, you went the route of pixelated graphics. So I don't know that you could have done something, you know, comparable. Or are you saying you would have liked to try your hand at a non-pixelated version?
No, I really wanted to make it in pixels, but I really wish our characters could be very much more detailed. Mm. And our shape are very simple. And because small objects in 3D did not render very well.
I see. Well, you know, you can always keep the idea for Dead Cells 2. That's fine. Or, you know. let's go back to the game as a whole. What would you say, each of you, makes this game a good game? You know, let's not go into hyperbole. Let's not go into, you know, it's a great game. It's an awesome, like, what would you say makes this game just a good game? A game that people want to play and that is successful from a, you know, design and enjoyment standpoint?
Actually, recently I was giving a talk about this specific topic, and it's really pretentious because it's like, okay, this is why our game is so good. That's something that I took from the reviews, you know, on Steam. And it's funny because when you read the positive reviews of the game, most of them actually, they don't talk about the Rogvania thing. They don't talk about the roguelike and everything. They do talk about it, but the first thing they do say most of the time, like most reviews do say that, it's the controls and the gameplay is smooth. Yeah. And that's all something that we actually feel when we go on events like Gamescom or Tokyo Game Show. And when we give the controller to someone, after 5 seconds, he says, nice. And it actually plays right. And that's something for me as a game designer, I'm really proud of this because I think it's part of the reason that people do like this game because it do plays quite right. It's still difficult, but it's not difficult because the controls are awful. And yes, I'm looking at you, Rogue Legacy. but I do love Rogue Legacy was a huge, very important example for us for the flow, but also for all its good ideas. So that's not me trolling.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was for me. It really is the controls that made the things easier and allowed to reach a broader audience.
Mm. You know, I worked for a few years at Blizzard, and I love their games. I was a bullshit artist at Blizzard as well. I was a PR manager, and I think you called your marketing and PR people bullshit artists. So that's why I'm saying that.
Himself a bullshit artist.
But Blizzard is a company that attaches a huge amount of importance to the core gameplay. Literally, one of their tenets is gameplay first. That is why they care about the most and what they craft the most carefully, I think. Was that also the intent when you started the game? Like, was that intentionally designed from the get-go, or did you fall into it thinking, okay, the game works like this, and we need a core gameplay loop which is satisfactory for this game to work? Or, you know, was it intentional, or did you fall into it, I guess?
I'm more like a Nazi when it's about everything which is smoothness and...
Okay.
game feel, exactly, that's the world. And I do believe that even at the prototype phase, the game should be fun because, yes, it's a Rogvania, yes, it's a roguelite, yes, you have crafting, yeah, you can unlock things. This is not the game, actually. This is the unique selling point and the global stuff of the game. But the game is just all about jumping and killing mobs. It's really right. Just about that. If you intend to do a game, and I think Blizzard does the same thing, if you're a game about killing things or jumping, you should really make sure that the jumping is actually fun and you just have fun just traversing the level. So that's really, for me, it's really, it was something that I cannot leave something which is not perfect because you cannot make perfect things, but as good as possible, especially when you talk about controls. Mm.
I love the analogy with jumping because, of course, Mario comes to mind, and the simple act of jumping is enjoyable in that game, and that's what you do for most of those games. And I can't imagine how much time the developers at Nintendo agonized over the exact control scheme and how the millisecond of jumping and resting and landing and everything took. how much time did you spend on those things? Like, is there, I don't know, maybe an anecdote of something that didn't feel quite right and you didn't know why, and you spent like the whole night at the office, you know, perfecting that one aspect of a role or something? Is there something like that you can tell us about?
Sure. There are many things. Actually, the part that took me the most time, and I think it's still taking me time today, it's really everything which is related to ledge grabbing on platforms.
Oh, really?
I do spend a huge amount of time making sure when you jump between two platforms, actually, when you arrive or you almost miss the platform at the end, I think I have about 10 different things that could happen at this point. Maybe you just missed from a few pixels. Maybe you are just beneath the platform. Maybe you are above, but there is an enemy nearby, so you want to attack right away. And you have many scenarios when you land on a platform. And I did spend, I don't think, months just making all the use case for this and implementing ways to grab or jump or teleport you where you thought you would land, not exactly where you actually are, but more like when you expected to land. And it was the most difficult part because it's really about actually understanding what the player is trying to do, but he failed. So you just are trying to cheat and make sure actually he succeeds.
Right, right.
Actually, the character snaps on platform.
Mm, yeah.
And it's on 1 or 2 pixels, maybe?
Yeah, something like this. And when you, for example, when you miss a platform, there are maybe 3 or 4 different situations where I just teleport you on the platform because I know what you are trying to do. Okay, you miss. We don't care because that's not the point in the game. It's not a good feeling when you miss a platform in a game.
So every time you jump to a platform, there's actually some computation that happens to resolve the result of your jump at the last second to make sure that decides, yes, this time we're going to snap you to it, or this time we're not going to. Or so it's not just...
Sorry, there is actually a small thing that I left in the game. It used to be debug feedback for me, but it's still there. And actually, when you are teleported on a platform, I just pop a small smoke under your feet when you are jumping between two platforms and you just reach the ledge of the platform. And when you are teleported, you have a small smoke pop that pops out on your feet. And when you see that, it's actually something happened.
Oh, nice. Okay, so that means if you see that, then you shouldn't have landed on the platform, but we put you there because we're nice.
Exactly.
What about you, Thomas? What would you say makes it a good game? Maybe it's the same core gameplay loop, but what's your take on it?
I will say that what Sebastian often says, I think we target to make a good Castlevania. And I think today a good Castlevania is a Castlevania as you remembered. So... Mm. We did not try to make this game like we did game 10 years ago. So I think that's the point that make Dead Cells a good game.
So it's really make things as you remember and not as they were, because they were not that great by this time.
That's a really interesting point, actually, especially since we have so much nostalgia happening. And I think a lot of people, it's always happened, but especially now, a lot of people say they want games from their childhoods. It's the case everywhere. You know, you have remakes all the time, not remakes, but remasters. And there are a few rare occasions where the games hold up when you had some really incredible game design at the time. But most of the time, the thing that people say they want isn't the what they really want. Does that apply to a lot of that part of the industry nowadays, or is it something that is, I don't know, a more occasional thing? What do you think about that aspect of nostalgia today?
You're actually on point when you say that, because, you know, for example, I'm a huge fan of Daggerfall, which is Elder Scrolls 2. Mm-hmm. For me, it's one of the best games ever. But I know I don't want to play Daggerfall again today. I just want to play Skyrim.
And right.
There is reason for this, because it's really all about the feeling that the game gave me at this time. It was, you know, the huge world map and everything. And actually, it's really not about the game, how it was. And I did play again Daggerfall a few weeks ago. And really, okay, it's nice and everything, but no, it's not a game that I can't play anymore. And I think, yes, when you are trying to make a game today, especially if you want to go for retro and pixel art or this kind of thing, if you want to make some kind of tribute to an old game, you should really not do the same thing. You should just, okay, grab the feeling and understand what was a good feeling that this game gave you, and not do the same thing. There is a good example. I do love Wonder Boy, you know, some Super Wonder Boy in Monsterland. It was on Atari ST or something.
Maybe Master System.
Genesis. Maybe Master System, you're right. And they did make a new Wonder Boy a few years ago. And when you can switch between the old game and the new game, and actually it's just a graphical remake. It's the controls are the same, and the controls are bad, because the game is really great, but the controls is really like in the 80s. And we don't want to play this kind of game anymore. There are so many things that did evolve. We know that double jump in 2D games is really important. We know many things that make actually gameplay just better, and it's really not about making game as they were. And I think that's as a player, it's really something that I'm a little bit pissed off to see in modern games. They do exactly as how it was, and they also take all the bad things with it.
The double jump is I want to ask you more about this, but the double jump is a great example, because you could make one jump longer. You could give the second jump at some point through the game, make it a power, but it feels like many, many games have double jump from the get-go, and I'm not sure why, because, as I said, mechanically you could make the one jump reach as far, but it's the, what do you think as a designer, it's the feeling of pressing the button twice, which is positive feedback for the player? Why is that?
In fact, when you have a double jump, there is a great analysis on this. I don't remember, it was on a video on YouTube. And actually, the double jump is more like you move the decision process of the player. You split this decision process in two. So when you decide to jump between two platforms, you don't have to anticipate like everything and make sure that your jump is right at the beginning. You can actually make a somewhat approximative jump, and then you can adjust in mid-air. And that's really what the double jump is all about. It's not about a poor player feature. It's really more a quality of life feature. It allows the jump to actually be slightly easier, because even if it's the same range, you can actually make a less precise jump right at the beginning, and you can adjust mid-air. That's why it's actually, for me, that's not something in any game I would lock at the beginning. I would just, because it's really just quality of life.
And it's a core feature of traversal for the game.
Yeah, there is another really not well-known example of this. You know, when you on a platformer game, when you are about to jump at the end of a platform, you just want to jump away. And if in our game, for example, and that's something that is also done in very various games, when you are leaving the platform, you can actually jump even if you are you have left the platform, but you still can jump for maybe one or two frames after leaving the platform.
Right.
And this is a very small detail, but if you don't have that, it forces the player unconsciously to actually anticipate everything. And actually, he jumps, he makes shorter jump, because he has always have to jump before the end of the platform. And this is the same for me. It's really a small detail that makes the jump. It's the same thing in the end. You can make the jump the same length, but it's really a quality of life detail. And the double jump is really all that for me. If it's not a game about jumping, which is not like a traversal game or a Dust Force or this kind of game, if the game is not about jumping, you should not make the jumping thing difficult. There's no reason for this.
So, yeah, I was going to ask, what kind of things did you do to get closer to the nostalgia and the memory of how Castlevania was, rather than making an actual Castlevania. I guess those are two examples, the double jump and the ledge jump. The two frames you can still jump when you're off the ledge and things like that. Do you have any other examples, you or Thomas, about making sure you get close to the memory of the game and not the actual game?
I think a good example, but it's the Sebastian Works. But when you target an enemy, and when you kill him, and there is an enemy in your back, your character automatically flip on himself to aim the. And this is not an input of the gamer to do that. So it makes the game feel very fluid. The Dead Cells is the best stuff of this kind of things.
Yeah, we do have tons of many hidden tricks like this to make sure that actually you succeed in doing what you're expected to do, like eating the enemy.
I never noticed. Does it really? How close does the enemy have to be for you to turn around to face him?
It depends on the weapon, but I don't think it works on ranged weapons, from what I remember. But for a close combat weapon, actually, if you are in range, you should actually turn around.
I almost don't believe you. If you weren't the actual designer of the game, I would not believe you. I never noticed. It must feel so natural that I didn't even, my brain didn't register it. That's crazy.
Yeah, because when you play, actually your brain wants to turn. So yeah. you do the move maybe a few frames too late, so you maybe attack then turn. But because we saw you attacked something, there is no one on your right and there is someone on your left. Also, again, there is no reason for not turning you to the enemy.
It's really interesting because all of those small things, I'm sure many games implement these things that we don't realize, but it makes the game feel smooth and natural. And there's, I guess, a limit because it almost, I mean, it doesn't play the game for you, but it does some actions for you that the game interprets as something you wanted to do but didn't manage to do. So arguably, it would make the game easier. But obviously, Dead Cells is not an easy game at all. So it's interesting to see that limit there of making it a quality of life and not actually making the game, not literally playing the game for you. It's very. Did you ever think, well, maybe we shouldn't do that because it betrays the purity, you know, of an actual game? Or did you ever think we shouldn't? Yeah,
I think not. We knew that the difficulty of the game. Should come from the role mechanics. So we wanted the player role at the right time, and this is the only thing we want him to do. Mm-hmm. So there is no reason to make difficult come from other things.
I see. Okay, so let's get back to Early Access for a second. Early Access had almost become, I think, in 2018, almost an ugly word because so many people were burned by Early Access games or even Kickstarter games that didn't fulfill their promises. But there were a few games, I think, Hollow Knight or a few others come to mind, and yours, of course, which had a very... successful, well, I think Hollow Knight was Kickstarter, not Early Access, but yours was Early Access, and it was a very successful Early Access. People were happy about it, even from the beginning, and kept following the development of the game, and finally when the game released, not 15 years after, but a year, maybe a year and a half after the Early Access began, I think a year and a half, people were happy to have supported it and were happy that it came out. And myself, I bought it in Early Access and rebought it on the Switch because, as we mentioned, every game like this is better on the Switch. What do you think made this Early Access development a success?
There was a talk recently from the guy, it was at Taipei, the guy from Subnautica. And for us, this game actually was a really good example on how to make early access in the right way. And we, as I said, when we went to early access, we were not really confident because we knew that there was Indie Apocalypse and everyone was shitting on early access. And so it was really not an easy move for us because we knew that we could fail like a lot if we didn't do the right thing. But this guy from Somnotica, he said something in his talk, which was you should consider early access and Kickstarter on every kind of thing as a show. And actually, early access is a show for the developer because you still have to make your game, but you also have to make
a show.
Some
you
sort
mean?
Of event.
Do you mean a trade show, like where you're presenting your game to the public? Is that in that sense?
It's more like a TV show.
Okay.
Making sure interesting things happens on a regular basis and make sure that your game doesn't go undercover for months or anything like this. You should really consider when you go to early access, it's really important to consider that there should be someone full-time working on making sure that the early access is actually publishing and having new things to show on a really regular basis.
And I think there is a key to succeed in early access is you can ship your game unfinished, but I think if you ship your game unfinished, it has to be perfect. Even if the content is poor, if the content is with a good come with a good quality, I think you can succeed on early access. And there is a lot of games that come on early access. It's not finished, and the controls are bad or unfinished too. We choose to ship our game in early access with only two bosses and maybe four levels,
five
levels. Yeah. But we really wanted that this part of the game. Is considered as a vertical slice with the final quality of the game. Like that, players that early adopters could see what the games could be at the end.
I see. And that was really the intent. You didn't want to launch the early access until, I guess when you say that the game is good, it means that the core mechanics of combat and rolling and all of this were almost finished. So the prototyping phase was a big part of the pre-early access development, correct?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes.
So and, yes, it's funny because we I talked a lot about prototype with my friend Gwenel, which is my right arm in graphic design. Mm-hmm. And I told him that the prototype is not sufficient
enough.
Is not enough. The vertical slice is really the milestone you need to know if your game is good to ship.
Mm-hmm.
And four or five biomes, I think you call them, is a big portion of the game. I mean, you have how many now? 10, 15?
I think 12, 13, something like this.
How many? Sorry, I didn't hear.
12 or 14, I'm not sure.
Right, so that is a third of the game. And if it is playable, as the final product will be, you have a lot of enemies in it, and it's a huge part of the game already finished. Then you, quote-unquote, only have to add new biomes. Maybe you have to add new weapons and refine the mechanics of each weapon, make sure it's fun. But it feels like maybe this is a misunderstanding of how game development works, which is very possible, but it feels like it's almost the adding content and polish phase. And the core game is essentially finished before you went to early access.
That's what we thought when we went to early access, because the marketing guy said us, we should really consider, and it was a very important point, we should consider the early access as the release date.
Right.
So we knew that when we went on early access, it was really important to make sure that everything was final quality as much as possible. And of course, we didn't have all the content, but it was really important to make sure that the product that we wanted to show to players was actually really close to the final game. And of course, you know, when you say a Kickstarter today, and when you talk about funding, it's really like not a secret for anyone, but it's not a funding. It's just a marketing, it's part of the marketing to go on Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. When you have something that you want to show on Kickstarter, it's really almost a finished product. And you just want to have some kind of buzzword on the internet. So that's why you go. And early access, we thought it would be the same. We thought it would be like just a first release before the second big one. But actually, during the early access, we actually changed so many things in the game and the gameplay and the core loops and everything. So it was a very different process because, yes, we wanted to have quality at first, but we thought we would not change gameplay, but we did.
It's interesting because, again, a point of comparison I have is Blizzard, for reasons that the audience, I think, understands. But I've always felt like the development process at Blizzard was that they would finish the game, then polish it for an extra year or maybe longer, and then release it. And that early, you know, everyone knows when you get into a Blizzard game, open beta or even closed beta, rather, the game is essentially finished. And then they add content and polish. And sometimes there are a lot of features that change, but it's usually the game is very playable from the early closed beta process. Would you say that this is a good, if you can afford it, if you can do it, a good development intent to essentially consider the game finished and then add an extra year to really finish it afterwards, but really have that target of the finished development a year before you're going to release?
I don't think it's a good thing because I think it's a good thing because it does work like this and players are okay with this idea today. But I don't think it's a good thing because it's really about making sure that when you buy an early access game or whatever access game, it's really about making sure that the player actually understands that the game is not finished and it will probably change. And the system is done now that it's not that obvious. So you can buy an early access game as easily when as a finished title. So for me, it's as a game designer, it's a little bit more difficult because I know if I have a game that and I show it live anywhere, I know it has to be properly finished because I know that the reviews, many few people, player will say, okay, that's okay, the game is not finished, so I won't post a bad review or anything. But you have also many, many people that will just blacklist the game because, okay, it's not fun, something is missing, the performances are bad or whatever. And
so
that's the issue for me.
I actually, maybe I didn't explain it right, but what I meant was an internal, even if you don't have early access or open beta or anything, like internally for the development process, is it good to think we should finish the game and then keep developing it without talking about it to anyone for another year?
Okay. Sorry, that's frustrating because you know when you are making a game, you just when you're ready, you just want to show it.
So yeah.
That's really perfect. But it really depends on the project. For example, for Dead Cells, it was not an issue because we knew it was it's an action game. There was no narration or not that much. So you don't have many things to learn from the game except the gameplay and skills. So it was not a problem to actually show the game in an early stage, like during the early access. But for example, for a really heavily narrative-driven game or something like this, it's really different because you cannot show the game until it's perfect because you know if you do that too early, you will spoil your game. Mm-hmm. So on your story, your surprise on the content of your game. A game like Hellblade, for example, there is no way for it to go on early access because you just cannot do that, except just want to test the combat system, but it will give the game a bad images image. How to say that?
Bad feeling.
Yes, because it's not a game about combat; it's a game about schizophrenia. So it really depends on the game. If you are on an action game, a roguelite, and everything, it's okay. But if you are on narrative, narration-based game, that's a different story.
You were talking about the fact that you need even in early access to have things that happen. And I noticed that during your early access, you had like patch and patch notes that were marketed. You had like different names. I'm French, so the baguette update is one that stuck in my mind. But it was really you looked at it like a live game. Updates with exciting things for each update that you would put forward for people to stay excited about the game.
Exactly, yes. When we built, it was also something that we took from Subnautica, but when we built the different updates on each updates, we decided to go, at the beginning we thought we would go for one update each month, but quickly it was really just not possible to do that because we're a small team. So we decided to go for something which were more like an update every 2 or 3 months, a major update. And each update, we wanted it to have some kind of, also similar to Blizzard, World of Warcraft updates. Each update should have something to, some kind of story to tell. And so it was, we wanted to change something important in each update and making sure it feels like more a DLC to the game, more like just a patch.
You guys also talk about the importance of the Chinese translation often. I want to ask you about that for a second. You ended up translating the game in Chinese a few weeks before the release of the early access, and almost as an afterthought, how important was it to have the game available in Chinese?
At the beginning, we didn't know that it will be so important on our sales. It's the hazard.
Someone gives
us a Chinese traduction of the game, and we say okay, we will put it in the game. But there is other thing. Our marketer said that there is a problem with games which are not in a Chinese language, is that Chinese people play a lot on Steam and could put bad reviews on our games, on Dead Cells, if there is no Chinese in it.
We did feel tons of bad reviews which are just not Chinese, written in Chinese. And and this is a review, even if you do translate the game after a while, it actually doesn't change anything. They do stick to their initial review. So that was also not a good reason for doing this. But yes, we are quite afraid of bad reviews at this point. And we thought it would be stupid not to do the Chinese version because it's just a matter of a few weeks. And we didn't know how important it would be at this point.
How much work is it to add a Chinese version, given the fact that it's a different, you know, character set, and I guess the coding, maybe it's already included in development tools nowadays, so it doesn't matter that it's Chinese characters. But how difficult was it? It's only a few weeks, but
it was quite a challenge because the texture for the Chinese character is actually the biggest.
It's a 4K texture.
It's a 4K or more or something. So you have so many different Chinese characters. And also we wanted a pixel art font. And actually we gave up on this idea, I think. But now it's more like a HD font. But yes, it was a difficult thing because the translation was something, but the technical issues, we did have many of them. Unfortunately, the text reads left to right, I think. Mm-hmm. Yes, so we didn't have to do anything too fancy about displaying text in the game.
Is the game of it? Oh, go ahead, sorry.
But because it was on Steam, we didn't have to do more than just translating the game. We didn't have to, comply with very specific Chinese rules about the red colors and skeletons and a few things like this. Because it was on Steam, it was a little bit easier to actually make the Chinese version. It was possible to do that in a short delay.
Sorry, I missed it. You said you didn't have to comply with the skeleton issues because culturally in China, you're not supposed to display the bones because it has, cultural implications. So you didn't have to comply with those, you said.
Yeah, because on Steam, it's they are in the gray zone for China. It's something that is changing now today. But they actually do sell games in China, but that don't comply completely. But now we are working on a full proper Chinese version because we want to do it properly. But it was really not possible to do it in a very short delay. We have been working on it for a few months, maybe, not sure, weeks or months. And so it do take quite a lot of time to actually comply to everything. But at this time, it was just about translating the game, and that was it.
And there is not only the skeleton issue. We can't display red as we want in the game. So if you make a red flag, it's forbidden.
Right. I see. Trying to start to wrap things up a little bit, what would you say to devs that are starting out? What are the most important things they should pay attention to when developing maybe their first or second game and trying to get a project off the ground?
I think I would give them two tips. The first one would be just make sure, as we talked a lot about core loops, but make sure that your core loops, and what I call core loops is actually the things that your player will do from the beginning till the end, so just jumping and killing enemies, for example. Make sure that your core loops are good and almost perfect, as good as possible. And the second thing would be it's not about releasing a game, it's actually making sure that you can make another one. And because, when you make a game, especially if it's your first one, there is so many people that actually do burn all their energy just making this game. And when they reach the release date, they actually are exhausted and they don't know at this point that they do have to work on the game for maybe a few months after. So
the release is not the end of the game, of the development.
The release is maybe like the 2/3 of the game, something like this, the life span of the game. But I would just summarize this as make sure when you release the game, make sure that you actually try to make a second game. And when you make the second game, make sure that you're trying to make a third game. Because it's really all about sparing your energy to actually survive this process and being able to be still there for the next game.
Mm. And I think there is another thing. Making a good game is not enough. You can believe that your game will work without any marketing effort.
Yes. Do marketing. It's not a dirty thing.
Marketing is not a dirty thing. Yes.
I'm really. I was really stricken by the practicality of your approach to everything and everything I've heard. And marketing is a good example. I think a lot of, maybe not a lot, but some. Indie developers are taking this kind of rebel approach F marketing, we're not going to do this, and this is some artificial BS, and you guys have that weird company structure where everyone is co-CEO, that might indicate to some people, oh, they're idealist, weird people who are against capitalism and don't hate money or that kind of weird thing. But you really do embrace the practicality of everything. Like, marketing is important and it has its place, and you shouldn't make a game that is hard for the sake of being hard. If a jump needs to snap to the ledge when it lands, then you do that. And these kinds of things, and even in the company structure, what makes all of this work? I don't know. Did you just find each other? And through that careful recruiting process where you try to get people that are better than yourselves, manage to create a team where everyone has that same result-oriented vision? Or how does your chemistry work at Motion Twin? Is there something to it?
Actually, we just do talk a lot, like a lot. We do lots of meetings. It's really every subject can be discussed and every decision can be changed. So that's something that may feel like it's a little bit dangerous and time consuming. And yes, it is in some way. But as long as you consider any subject, even the ones that you don't like, for example, for me, it was really the marketing thing was not something I would embrace in at any point. But I did for Dead Cells because someone just explained me that the good reason for doing it, and especially showed me the good ways to do it. And you know, when you don't like something, it's really better not to just, okay, I won't do it for anything, for any reason. It's a better idea to just, okay, I will do it my own way. And so when you make marketing, for example, if you don't like marketing, that's okay. But you should consider then how you could make your own marketing in a good way for you, for your own karma. So it's really all about that. It's not about, there is no reason. When you work on a game for 2 years, and it would be stupid to just say, okay, I did work like really hard on my game and I won't do anything to sell it. And because it's, why just doing that? It's not for the sake of making a game. It's really, you want to have a game, but you also want to have a player actually do play your game and maybe selling it if it's a paid game. So there is no really good reason to actually ban marketing or anything like this. And so it's the same for every topic. So if there is no reason for completely banning it, you should just try to do it your own way.
And in our decision, we always considered the happiness of people in here. So when we make a decision, when I make a decision, I need to know that my co-partners are happy with this, and I think it's the key.
Was there ever a... So, as we mentioned a couple of times, Thomas, you're the lead artist, also co-CEO. Was there ever... And, you know, artists are sometimes divas, and they have these ideas about how things will work and how this would be so much better, but the public just doesn't understand. And was there ever a moment where you thought something was really important and you really wanted to... you know, have it in the game or in the marketing material or a method of doing things, and you got a meeting with everyone and maybe your idea got shut down or you ended up convincing them? Like, I can't imagine, you know, the bane of every company, I think, is meetings. Like, a meeting when there's more than three people lasts forever. Mm-hmm. No one understands what you're trying to say. Everyone is just waiting to talk, or even worse, forced to say something to not sound dumb. Did you have any difficult meetings that ended up resolving favorably or unfavorably, or how do they work?
At first, the lead artist term is a joke because I was the only graphist at the beginning of the project. So
yeah, so I think it's the case for all
I
of
need
the...
to be.
Yeah.
So and it's very funny because the other lead artist on Dead Cells arrived just after me on the project. So
well, he's also lead artist. Listen, I never said you were the only lead artist.
At the beginning, I set the art direction and all kind of stuff. We need to make the graphics looks good. But after that, when he arrived in Motion Twin, I said to him, "You are now lead artist on your part. So deal with it. I can help you, but and I have a lot of animation to do and a lot of characters to do. So I let him do what he wants." Wanted to do so. We are two lead artists on Dead Cells. It's very weird to say, but it's the truth. And what was your question? If it's difficult to explain ideas to my team,
yes, everyone has to agree to every decision. It seems like an unwieldy process.
But as a graphic artist, there is something very, very efficient to convince your teammate to do something is just to draw it. It's simple as that. When you have an idea, you can explain it for 1 hour how you want the sky looks or how do you want the light to be in the game. Just draw it and show it to your team, and if it's ugly, they will say it to you.
but you didn't. You just trust them, their judgment, like their judgment. Sorry, there wasn't
I
a moment
trust their
where
judgment and I trust mine when I show my team some drawings. I choose wisely which one I wanted to show them. I make a lot of sketches, but I put a lot in the trash before show them to the team.
As you said, everyone is a lead in its own domain, and it's always the same when someone is actually, for example, the lead artist on the animation or background. When he says something, yes, we can have our own opinion, but in the end, he will decide. And because it's really the way that we do work. We don't have any kind of boss. We are more like everyone is a boss. But depending on the topic, you will have someone who will have some sort of lead on this because he's the one in charge of this. So sometimes everyone will disagree. So that can still happen. But then in such a case, this person should actually change or understand and adapt. But most of the time, when someone who is in charge of something, when he decides something, it's quite a rare situation that we actually go in the opposite direction. Most of the time, we just also have confidence because this is his job, so he might be good. We hope so.
And I think it's very easier to decide on your work when you can use your teammate's intelligence to do this.
How do you do that?
You just ask them what they think, and you keep what you wanted to keep, and it's, if it's interesting, it helps you to decide.
Yeah, actually, the process is something like someone has an idea on any kind of topic, and the good thing at this point is should I try to implement or to test or to prototype this idea in very rough thing. And then after, you should maybe ask to just one or two people in the team what do they think about this idea or topic, and if it's okay, then we go on meeting. So usually when you reach the meeting point, it's usually because either because there was really no possible decision and no one actually knows what to do, so that can happen, but it's not that frequent. But most of the time, it's just because, okay, we are already experimented, discussed about this, so it's just a matter of validation.
And approving, yeah. It seems like there's a surprising amount of trust in the team. You trust that when someone makes a decision, unless you're like super opposed to it, they made the right decision because they're competent and they have done their job in researching and prototyping and whatever. So interesting.
The key point, you know, it's because this person is paid the same way as me. So because this person is interested in the success of the project exactly the same way as me, it's obvious that this person is also trying to make the best game possible. So that makes everything.
So I guess the one danger in that structure would be if someone is just, you know, not working as hard and riding the coattails of the company because they know they'll be paid no matter what. But I guess to counteract that, if it's a small team, everyone knows each other, so there's motivation because you're working with your friends. But also, if you see that someone is not delivering the results, I guess, I don't know how it works exactly, but I guess something like a majority of the company can decide to fire someone, and there's that threat, is that the case, or
Some people could leave the company?
Most of the time it happens like this. When someone actually feels bad in the company, he actually just leaves by himself. But the thing is, no one can hide anywhere. So it's really if you are having any kind of issues in your job, actually everyone sees that quite quickly. So when we have someone who has, for example, who is tired and is doing shit in his job, we just ask him, okay, you should maybe go home and have some rest and come back next week. And we just try to take care of everyone like this because we know, because we are a small company, we know that everyone is important, so we cannot afford to have someone burn out. Or...
Yes, our structure and organization comes with a lot of peer pressure. So we have to manage that. There is some people are very comfortable to talk in public, other not really. So it's not that happy all the time. We need to take care about that. And yes, the burnout issue is taken very seriously.
So did you manage, I guess you can't completely avoid a crunch time, but did you manage to manage it well enough? Or did you do you manage to go home at 5 or 6 every night? How does it work?
No, not at all. We did crunch a few times, but it was always something that people decided by their own, on their own. But every time we did crunch, it was really the most stupid thing that we did, probably. Of course, you sometimes have deadline and you have to comply to it because you have something to release or some kind of patch to push. But most of the time when we did crunch, it was really not a good idea and things didn't went really right. So we really try to avoid this as much as possible. And when we see someone who actually works during the weekend, we just ask him to stop in a nice way, because even if it's it might be productive in a very short term, we know in the long term that it doesn't work. And it creates feelings of, okay, I do more, give more to this project than my colleagues, and this kind of bad idea. Which is something that we now we know that we have to avoid this kind of situation.
The other problem with working on weekends is you work alone, and we need to work as a team.
And I guess you have all of these teachings have come through. How old is the company? 15 years, so you have experience there.
We used to have something which was absolutely terrible, because we used to have a bot internally. It was called Marvin, you know, after the Hitchhiking Guide to the Galaxy. Yes, Marvin.
Yes.
And this bot, it was like our human resources bot in the company. And actually, you could send him like a mail or something. You could report on someone on this bot, and this bot was making the job of actually telling the team there is an issue with this person in the team.
Like, but anonymously.
Exactly. And we didn't need to build this bot because we are all bosses and everyone is equal. It was really difficult to actually when you had an issue with someone, especially when we are more people. It was really difficult to actually understand, is it an issue I just me alone have with this person, or is it more like a global issue that we should really discuss in a meeting? And the job of this bot was to actually sort of things and making sure that is it a single report or is it like the third report on this person? So yes, we should make a meeting.
Yeah, the tricky part when you have a problem, an issue with a teammate, is that if we did not have this bot, maybe I will try to convince other people there is an issue with this one, but maybe I am the only one with the issue. So, yeah.
I see. Well, it's really a fascinating thing, and it feels incredibly, you know, almost a communist in the implementation of the idea that everyone is equal, and at the same time, extremely capitalist, because everyone is making all the money that the company is creating and working hard, fairly, but hard to make a great product that you can sell. So it's a weird mix of fairness and trust and hard work and everything. And I'm sure, you know, obviously, even though you don't say so, you have very good marketing people that told you exactly what to say to present Motion Twin as this paradise company. But let's leave that aside for a second. I'm sure you have problems too, like every company and every people in the world. But there is one aspect which I do want to cover a little bit. You're going to have, or you're having now, a lot of money coming in the company. And as we all know, money does change things. So I'm sure you can't say how much money is coming in and you're making, but we all know that it's a lot. So are you afraid that this will change the dynamic in the company? Like, how do you manage? You said very clearly you need to make sure you make another game after the one you release. How are you handling the big success, financial success of the game with all of this?
It's divided in two parts, actually. There is one part which is spread among the everyone, every co-CEO and lead whatever in the company. So this is a good part because everyone is paid quite a lot, of course, because we did have success. But we also when we went on early access with Dead Cells, as I said, the company was not in a good shape, and because we were turning away from the mobile and web nightmares, and we wanted to do something different and go on PC and console, we knew at this point it was really a difficult situation for us. So we don't want to reproduce that. We want to make sure that now we did have a success. We don't really want to use this success to be sure that we can make another game and another one after this one. So we do also save a lot of money just to make sure that we actually have enough and we know that we have a few years we can afford to make the next game as good as possible because we are not in too much in a hurry. So it's really and also the money that everyone is getting from the game, we also discussed about it a lot, and that's something we also want to make sure that everyone is not like buying 10 cars and burning its money. It's really important. Yes,
you don't know that.
I don't know. I don't care. But that's something that we did discuss, that to make sure that it was also money that was important to use for everyone, to make sure that, okay, you can feel safe and you can make your next game in a quite a safe situation. You are not you don't have you can now pay the bills, so you can make your next game in a quite comfortable situation.
I think the main problem will be when we all have enough money to you are not forced to work. That's in my opinion the main issue. But honestly, for me, those numbers, I was very happy with my precedent salary. So those numbers now, it's very. I don't know how to manage. It meant nothing to me because I was happy before. I was happy to work with my colleagues and in Motion Twin. So now we laugh a lot about money, but even if it's bad, because we are very, very lucky. And I think I keep this in mind. There is a lot of luck in our story.
Yes. It's, right now, we are really thinking about the next things. And we know that we will probably fail on the next game. So I don't know. Of course, I really hope we do another success. But, you know, it's something where luck, as I said, Thomas, is really part of the thing. So maybe the next game will be like an awful bomb and it won't work. And maybe the next one, too. We really don't know. So now we think about it and we try to anticipate this possible failure and just making sure that this money is not like we don't buy tons of cars and boats.
Right. So you have the ability to make more than just one next game. And I mean, even myself, I love the game very much, but I completely understand that luck is a factor, and being a one-hit wonder is a real danger for a company, for any company, for anyone. So it's good to hear that you are aware of the possibility as well. And I mean, if I'm being honest, and it's not because you're here, I think the core of the intent of the game is good enough that it means there's a development team behind it that can do great things more than once, so I'm hopeful there. But it's good that you're taking precautions. That's really good to hear.
That's because it was part of our story. Even if people are not in Motion Twin since the beginning, I was, for example, and I do know that the story of Motion Twin is really full of really big successes in France and also huge failures. And so we know it's really the way a company works. It's not about making a game and just making it. It's really about making multiple games and making sure one of them succeeds.
And I think in Motion Twin, we are able to take risks. And I think that's why the work is very cool.
So, I mean, the thing that makes you different from every other company in this context is that you can't really scale the company, even with all the revenue that's coming in now, unless I misunderstand, but I think you're happy with the size of the company now. So you're probably not going to have another team or, you know, work on three games or scale the company to a larger size. So you're still going to be working in that small team, right?
We hope so, yes, because even as I said previously, even if it's some kind of limitation, it's also interesting because you have to optimize everything, and you can make big things. I think it's possible to make like an open world game or this kind of thing, but you have to think it the Motion Twin way. You have to think about it and how we make like a big game, for example, with such a small team. And for example, the animation, it was an obvious topic for this, but it was how to make maybe I'm not sure 20 enemies and maybe thousands of frames of animation for the main character with just one person. So this is really about how to make sure how you can make a big game with a small company.
Really interesting. All right, we're going to start wrapping it up. I have two questions that should be really quick. First, as we mentioned, you're not going to be talking about your next projects, even though, you know, feel free to, if you're, you know, marketing people understand the value of podcasts. So when you want to announce your next game, feel free to come back and I'll be happy to host you for the small audience that I have. But seriously, though, for Dead Cells, where are you? Are you polishing things? I know that you're working on a smoother version of the Switch version. But is the development essentially over, or are you going to add things to the game? I guess is my first question.
For the Switch, yes, we are working on the performance update. There is a small one which is coming really as soon as possible, maybe next month, I hope, which is really a small fix. So it won't change things much, but it will actually make a few things better. And the big update for Switch will come a little bit after, which will change actually the engine to make sure that it works much better on Switch.
Oh,
so
really?
Hopefully by... Okay. Yeah, so that's really a technical thing, but we hope to come by the end of the year or something.
Okay. I do want to mention, I know some people were complaining about it. There are a few frame skips sometimes, from time to time, but I would really... Yeah. It's minor. It seriously is minor, and I would still recommend the Switch as the version to get because of the things we talked about. So, didn't want to mention that.
Yes, and the next update, the next fix will actually at least patch a few major issues like the camera jumping away from the character suddenly or this kind of thing. So the obvious thing will be fixed, but the more complicated and deep elements and engine related things that will be fixed maybe by the end of the year. And apart from this, we're also working on two free DLCs. And the first one should come live maybe in one month or two. It will be like a really huge balancing update. We are fixing tons of things and all the issues that we couldn't fix on the release date, and also balancing issues with the highest difficulty modes. And then after this update, which will be really gameplay oriented and content, not much content oriented. And the next one will be actually more content oriented because we'll add new bosses to the game and new biomes to explore. So it will come hopefully at the beginning of next year. So, yeah.
Okay, that's pretty cool. It leads me to another question. I'm sorry, but. There is a way to play the game which focuses, this is going to be interesting to people who already play it, not those who don't, but if you focus on purple updates and you use I can't find the words, the weapons that you throw on the ground and that shoot the enemies from afar.
Yeah.
And so you focus on that and you go really high in the purple damage. And I was wondering, from a gameplay perspective, surely you have seen this mode of playing, and it makes it a little bit easier for people who use that, because they almost don't have to kill enemies themselves. They just throw out the... Is that something that bothered you, that you wanted to alter, or is it one of the ways to play the game and you're fine if some people choose to play it like that?
So, you know, there is a paradox when you make turrets in a game or any kind of automated weapon.
Thank you, turrets. I'm such an idiot. Yeah.
And when you make turrets in a game, as a game designer, you always face the same issue, which is should the turrets actually be more powerful than the player? Because everyone wants that. But as a game designer, most of the time you just say, oh no, I just want to be a sidekick weapon, and the player should be the main damage dealer in the game. But at one point I decided, oh, I think it's fine if you really want to play full ranged weapons and you don't want to take part in the combat and you just want to see your minions killing enemies. If it makes the game slightly easier, but it's really the way that you want to play, I'm fine with that. But the issue here is not about this gameplay. It's really more about people feeling they are forced into this gameplay because they can't beat the game in any other way. So it's really more about making sure that the two other directions should actually have their power play in some way. You should have ways to play and be really powerful if you do play brutality or if you do play survival. It's really not about... I just don't want to force very advanced player to play in tactical builds because they cannot beat the game in any other direction. So it's really more about this issue.
I have to admit, the interesting thing, though, is that playing with a tactical build allowed me to get farther in the game, where I had to become mechanically better, because if I didn't, I would just get almost one shot. So it allowed me to progress, but then confronted with stronger enemies, I had to up my game in the core gameplay as well. So that was an interesting... It was almost like a crutch I hold on to progress, but making me better in the process. So that was an interesting way of doing things. All right. Thank you very much. Last question, which has nothing to do with Dead Cells or Motion Twin. What are your favorite games of maybe this year? We can, slide to last year if you want to. But what are your favorite games, the games you're playing this year, the games you can't stop playing when you're, you know, in your very reasonable work conditions, going home at 5 every day with one of the most successful games of the year? What do you play at home?
I played a lot with Monster Hunter World, but I can't really say it is my favorite game yet. I didn't find it yet. So I'm waiting for it, maybe. Maybe, but the last game that completely absorbs me was Skyrim.
Oh, really? Skyrim? You mean the game from 2011?
Yeah.
Because you hadn't played it before, or...
No, I did not find any another game that could absorb my brain, even if I'm not playing it.
Since like, okay, so you mean you played it?
Yes. There is one, Nier Automata, of course.
Oh my God! Okay, I have things to say about Nier Automata.
Not for the gameplay, but for the narrative content.
I did not like Nier Automata, which makes me a paria of the internet. But let's not get into that.
I understand. I really don't like the combat system in Nier Automata, but it's really a game that moves me in the narrative content.
I'm one of the few people that don't like the gameplay or the narrative content. But I don't talk about it too much because I get thrown, you know, tomatoes in the street if I do. Cool. Okay. What about you, Sébastien?
For me, I didn't play any game for long. You know, as you grow older, I think it's probably the same for everyone. But as you grow older, you actually don't get interesting really for a long time in a game. because you have your daddy stuff and everything. But for me, the last one, I did spend quite a huge amount of time. It was Legend of Grimrock. You know the first one? Mm-hmm. You know this one?
Yeah. Legend of Grimrock,
Yes, actually, there is someone who is actually really crazy, and he made a mod on Legend of Grimrock. He made the old Dungeon Master game, the original one, actually fully playable in Legend of Grimrock 1. And it was I did spend a few weeks just playing it like crazy, because when I was a kid, I did play Dungeon Master, but it was really too complicated for me. I didn't get anything, especially because it was in English also. And it was really a huge thing for me to actually play it from the beginning till the end. Even if it was on Legend of Grimrock engine, it was really very close to the original experience. So. Yeah, I think it was this one, and before that it was Metal Gear 5. So yeah, I'm not I did try really tons of recent titles, but I didn't spend that much time in them.
Okay. So we have Skyrim on one end and Dungeon Master mod in Grimrock on the other. You know, I thought Thomas went a little bit far away in time, but Sebastian, you managed to beat him. So well done. All right, cool. Well, thank you so much for spending an hour and a half speaking to me and answering my dumb questions. It was really fascinating. Is there anything you wanted to tell the audience as we close it off? Or maybe, you know, I mean, Motion Twin, you have a website, Dead Cells, everyone knows the game. Go play it, go buy it if you haven't already. But anything else you want to tell people?
Sure, we don't talk about the next project.
Because nobody knows what it will be. I just want to say thank you to all our players that paid Dead Cells tons of hours. We have some stats and it's crazy.
And especially for the feedback. That's not something that we expected when we went to Early Access, but it was really so many feedbacks that were really on point in terms of gameplay or design or whatever. And that was really amazing and really great experience. I would love to make another Early Access title.
This is a big discussion for the next project, if it will be an Early Access or not, because, you know, when you have 100,000 players that make the QA with you, you have a better game at the end. So yes, a big discussion.
But I mean, we can talk about it.
But so you might go Early Access for the next game, not because you want to sell the game, but because, oh well, I mean, that's always a bonus, but because you get such valuable feedback for the development of the game. That's interesting.
Yeah, we pass the QA for a console like nothing. Yes,
yes.
It was very easy because 100 players helps us to make this great this game very great.
Well, thank you for enabling those players to let you make this game so great, because I really like the game itself. So thank you for making it. Thank you for spending time with me. Thank you to the listeners for listening in. We will be back very soon with another regular episode of the show. If you want to comment, you can go to frenchspin.com to comment on this episode. If you speak French and you enjoy gaming and gaming shows, you can listen to Le Rendez-vous Jeu, which I do in French. You can also listen to Le Rendez-vous Tech, which talks about tech news and which I do in French as well. So I hope you enjoy that. My Twitter handle is NotPatrick. I will include those of our guests in the show notes as well if you want to go pester them on Twitter. And I will talk to all of you very soon. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.